decent projects. They're monsters. I just can't understand why Bosnians would do deals with them.
The night fell on the Congo. 1 week after Goldfinger got his hands on the debt, the president was assassinated.
By that time, six other nations had invaded Congo, and millions were dead. So there was no real government of Congo, and no one to argue Congo's case when the vultures sued. Then, the story switches from Congo to the real heart of darkness, New York City, home of FG Hemisphere. FG attempted to grab the diplomatic buildings of the Congo, but a judge said no. They began to go after any company anywhere in the world that traded with Congo. The vultures demanded Congo's money be handed over to them. They couldn't sue anyone in British courts because of a new law that was brought in after we exposed their activities. But in America, courts still permit vulture claims. Congresswoman Maxine Waters has sponsored a new law to halt vulture collections. But her bill has been blocked by speculators led by billionaire vulture Paul Singer. Singer is the number one New York donor to the Republican Party.
In the run-up to the 2000 election, he gave them $300,000. In 2004, he gave them $1.2 million, including money for the so-called Swift Boat campaign, which smeared the war record of George Bush's opponent.
Singer roosts on Fifth Avenue, Manhattan.
36th floor, Elliott Associates, home of billionaire Paul Singer. Singer practically invented the Vulture Fund.
Singer bought some discounted debt from Congo Brazzaville for only about $10 million. His company then sued Congo and turned the $10 million into $127 million. But that still wasn't enough.
I'm right here, in fact, at 712 Fifth Avenue. Okay. Is there any time or any place where I can meet with Mr. Singer?
We've tried to talk to the billionaire.
Absolutely no way ever.
If Congress doesn't act, $100 million from the Congo will end up here at 300 Calve Avenue, Brooklyn, the offices of Vulture Fund FG Hemisphere. It appears to be a garage. I thought we should chat.
Mr. Grossman, hi. Greg Pallas, BBC and Guardian. Do you think it's fair that your Vulture Fund has sought $100 million from the Congo?
Yeah, I do, actually. Well,
you do, for a debt that you paid only $3 million for. Yeah,
that's not true. Yeah.
But do you know that the transfer of the debt to you was called a crime by the police? Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
You're not familiar with that?
I'm not beating up the Congo. I'm collecting on a legitimate claim.
You're collecting on a legitimate claim. So that, in other words, the $100 million goes better to you than UNICEF, which says that it could use that $100 million to save 200,000 lives.
Mr. Pallas, let me ask you a favor.
Okay, sure.
This kind of guerrilla journalism doesn't work for me.
Back in the Congo, school kids are waiting for their school to get clean water, maybe even desks or chairs.
What's your favorite subject?
Mathematics and French.
This is Congo's hope. This is Congo's future. Unless, of course, the vultures snatch it away. This is Greg Pallas in the Congo for BBC and The Guardian and Democracy Now!
Greg Pallas is an investigative reporter with the BBC. New book is called Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. Well, as we wrap up the show, Democracy Now! Has three paid fellowships available beginning in January 2012. We've extended our application deadline through Wednesday. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Armante Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Ryan Devereux, Dina Guzder, Manal Khan, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Nick Illa, Hugh Grant, Jessel Noor, Jessica Lee, Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
Tune in every Monday morning for the latest in campus news and left-of-center commentary from Stony Brook University's progressive student publication, Think Magazine. The smartest takes on the biggest stories with some of the best thinkers on campus. Think Out Loud, every Monday morning at 10 a.m. right here on WUSB Stony Brook 90.1 FM and online at thinksb.com.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook. And it's 6:01 p.m. outside, inside too. It's time for another exciting edition of Off the Wall. And good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Manuel Goldstein here with you, having caught my breath. You know, this is one of these days where it just seems like the whole world is just going too slowly. It's, yeah, okay, it's raining outside. Get it, it's raining. But, you know, that's no reason to go 20 miles an hour on a road where the limit is 50, and there's only one lane, so you're stuck behind the same idiot for 5 miles, and then as soon as that person decides it's too dangerous to go 20 miles an hour, someone gets right in front of him and does the same thing. And then you wind up on campus where all of a sudden they've decided to plow all the roads and do all kinds of crazy things. They even have those big, huge construction signs now that say major delays ahead. They have that now on campus, and there's traffic like I've never seen before. So, I've been close before getting to the station, but never as close as tonight. Unless I actually was late once, but literally running in here with 3 seconds left in Amy Goodman's program and nonchalantly just hitting a button for a promo to play so that listeners would never know the close call that I had just experienced. Except that I just told you, so. That's why I'm catching my breath, because I had to deal with people apparently in comas on the highways today. Okay, we have another abbreviated program because there's another basketball game. This time Columbia has decided to come out to Stony Brook to get their asses kicked. Okay, fine. We can accommodate. That starts at 6:45 and leaves us a precious little time. And also, I should point out, this is going to be the last live show for a while. We're having all kinds of equipment issues here, and it's very, very difficult to get copies of the program up online with what we have going now, and I know most of our listeners listen after the show is on. So we're going to be doing some pre-recorded shows until things get sorted out here, and hopefully that won't be too long. But next week it's a trip backwards a little bit, not in quality, hopefully, but in time. We're going back to New Year's Eve in Berlin, and won't that be fun? And at the end of November to hear a New Year's Eve program. So that will be coming your way. And then all kinds of other travel-related programs will be coming as well. So hopefully the world won't go any more crazy than it's already gone, although it probably will. Of course, there's always Off the Hook. We'll be live on that show on Wednesday nights. Wow, what a week. It really has been pretty incredible. And I trust that most of our listeners follow the news. They know what's going on in the world. They try to keep up to date on things. And hopefully what we talk about here tonight is not being too repetitive. And hopefully it's something that you're already a little bit familiar with. I'm talking about the actions that happened in New York City last Thursday, the things that have been going on around the country. It points to what I consider to be a sickness, a real sickness in the way that we deal with people. And by we, I mean our society, because it's a part of us. We may see these actions and be disgusted, but we enable them. We enable them by not stopping them. And, okay, of course, I'm talking about the whole Occupy movement and what's going on. No, the Occupy movement is not what's disgusting, not at all. That's something that's incredibly healthy and necessary, in fact. But what has really shown a sickness in our society is the reaction to it, and how we don't seem to be able to even tolerate any kind of critique. It makes us really uncomfortable, and we have to react in the strongest possible terms. And it reflects what's going on in the rest of the world. It certainly does. Now, people compare the Occupy movement to the Arab Spring. They call it the American Autumn, which I think is actually, it's got negative connotations. I mean, spring is something where life is beginning. Autumn is where things are dying. Leaves falling off the trees and winter just around the corner. You say American Autumn, it makes it sound like the end is near. So I don't know if that's really a good rallying cry to inspire people, unless you're trying to put an end to some of these outdated concepts. And then, hey, bring on winter, as far as I'm concerned. Absolutely. But there are lots of comparisons you can draw. Of course, people are dying in the streets of Cairo and Damascus and all kinds of other places in that region. And people are standing up for just the right to vote, the right to be heard, the right to do things that we take for granted, the things that we actually ignore. So we can really be inspired by people with that much integrity. But it's the reaction that is almost exactly the same, no matter where you look. Whether it's in Seoul, Korea, which I saw some riot police spraying some peaceful protesters today. Didn't even have a chance to know what they're protesting against. It's just that reaction is the same. In Syria, in Egypt, and everywhere you can possibly look, you see this heavy-handed tactic. And I guess I was under the fantasy that it was different here. But if you took even a slight look at what happened in New York City on Thursday, there's very little chance that you could go away with the idea that it's different here. It's exactly the same here. Exactly the same. The heavy-handed tactics that were used against protesters that weren't even fighting back, that weren't throwing rocks, that weren't throwing Molotov cocktails, that weren't lighting police cars on fire, didn't seem to matter. You still got your beaten in. You still got kicked and punched. And you still got your ass hauled off to jail if you just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Happens all the time, all over this country as well. And the reaction against something as harmless, and I'll put that in quotes, harmless as peaceful protest, it's very telling. It's telling to see how the response is against that kind of a thing. Now, the reason why I put harmless in quotes is because it is harmless. Physically, it is harmless. Mentally, it starts raising some doubts in the average American's eyes and ears and minds that maybe everything isn't quite as peachy keen as we think it is. But I'll say most of the damage is done by watching the reaction and asking yourself, what are they so afraid of? What is it exactly? And, you know, watching things unfold, actually, this all began about a week ago, a little over a week ago, when NYPD moved in and forcibly evicted people from Zuccotti Park. You got to ask yourself, first of all, what exactly is the harm? What harm were they causing being there in tents? I mean, yeah, people say, oh, it was a lawless place. No, it wasn't a lawless place. It was actually probably one of the safest places in the city to be. I've been there many times. And were there crimes committed? Yeah, there are crimes committed on any block in New York City, true. But here's what's interesting. If a crime was committed, and I know this from firsthand experience because I know somebody who actually got into an altercation in Zuccotti Park. I don't really know the details. I'm not sure who was more at fault or whatever. The point is, there was an altercation and there was a blow exchanged. And when this person went to the police to say, hey, there's some guy in there that just hit me. Can you do something about it? The police refused. They said, we're not allowed to go in there. We can't go in there. If we go in there, there'll be a riot. Which is a pure lie because many times I've seen police in Zuccotti Park and there was not a riot. But this kind of passive-aggressive way of dealing with it, saying, well, you know what, we're going to stay out of it because if we go in, it's going to cause problems, so we're just going to let the problem play out inside, and then that way we can say that it's all lawlessness inside and anything goes. You see how it works. You see how the idea gets planted and people just stand by and let it get worse. So that's kind of what was going on there. If you're actually inside the park, it was really a very safe place to be. But yeah, there were problems because you had about 1,000 people camped out in one square block. So yeah, you know, there was their own security force. There were all kinds of things that that they took care of themselves. But the police offered absolutely no assistance as they would with any other group until it was time to crack down, and then they were all over the place. So. It was interesting to see that unfold. We basically heard the reports throughout last Tuesday morning. And here's what's interesting. I was reading this this webpage on CTV, which is a Canadian network, and they had on their news department, they first reported as of, let's see, what time? About 4 in the afternoon. The headline said, New York judge says occupiers can return to park. New York Supreme Court Judge Lucy Billings said the protesters are allowed to take tents and other gear back into the protest zone, which is operated by a Canadian company, incidentally. Brookfield. Yeah, I didn't know that. However, it appears that police are still on the scene and barring demonstrators from returning. Interesting report there. So the Supreme Court judge said, hey, it's okay for them to come back. The police refused to comply. Then, hours later, same story, slightly different. New York judge says occupiers can't bring tents to park. Supreme Court Justice Michael Stallman said that while the protesters are entitled to free speech, that right doesn't mean they can camp indefinitely in the privately owned park. So, you know, I'm asking myself, what exactly happened there? There was a ruling. New York City didn't agree with it. They refused to allow people to come back into the park until they got a ruling they liked. That's how that reads to me. Either this story is completely wrong, and there is no Supreme Court Judge Lucy Billings who said it was okay to take tents into the park, because I couldn't find this story anywhere else. So either she doesn't exist and the story was completely wrong, or something really foul went on last Tuesday as far as getting the court to agree with New York City's rules, what they wanted to do. And then, of course, what happened on Thursday was simply unbelievable. It was a day of action, meaning that all kinds of demonstrations were planned, sit-ins, civil disobedience, that kind of a thing. You would think that Al-Qaeda was holding a recruiting convention in Madison Square Garden, the way the police responded and the way they reacted to people who were simply in the streets. Now, I've been in many demonstrations. I've been in many cities where there's been unrest, where things have been happening. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean you can't get to where you need to go. It doesn't mean that life doesn't go on, and to some degree anyway. But it was as if the police thought that they were sucking the oxygen out of the city and that they had to be stopped immediately. The way they responded, almost with hysteria. Now, in fact, I will say with hysteria, not almost. There was no excuse for the way that they came down so hard on people who just happened to be in a particular place that the police didn't want them to be. Well, you know, if someone is sitting on a sidewalk and you don't want them to sit on the sidewalk, well, you know, you can make a big deal out of it, and you can hit them, and you can spray them, and you can force them to move. But isn't that worse simply walking away and saying, okay, stay on the sidewalk? Isn't that kind of a microcosm to, okay, stay in the park, leave your tents there. It's going to be wintering. You really want to camp outside? Fine, go ahead. You know, it's I guess a bit callous to simply ignore people, but it's a lot better than using brutality against them. So I'm just trying to put myself in the position of authority figures. What's going through their minds? And I think what's going through their minds is panic. They want control so badly that something as small as people sitting on a sidewalk or occupying a park suddenly becomes a real danger, because if you don't get them to move over there, you've lost control. And it's all going to start falling apart. I think we really learned something from this. In seeing that reaction, we saw the panic. And on Thursday, the police really lit the fuse. And yeah, they did. They lit the fuse. It's really going. Now, you might not know it from reading mass media, but there are people still in Zuccotti Park. True, not as many. But right now, what you have tens of thousands of people, if not many more, throughout this country who are angry, who are outraged at what they've seen in the past week, who are very disillusioned in their country and are thinking in a totally different way. And it's all because of that reaction. Yeah, the protest was one thing. The protest galvanized people, gave them a voice, but seeing that disgusting reaction against them, wow. Now we know we're on to something. And then, of course, what happened in California. Wow. We saw, I imagine we've all seen this, maybe not, but basically at the University of California in Davis, campus security pepper sprayed in the face a bunch of students who were simply sitting down on the street. And again, we had the situation where they wanted them to move and they said no. So rather than simply say, okay, you know what, we'll go around this way instead. Or we'll just walk away and you can chant and wear yourself out and feel like you've done something. But we're big enough to just ignore you. Even though it's not really that big at all to ignore somebody. But instead of doing that, this horrible, horrible person. And he's one person, but it obviously represents a policy because nobody stopped him. He just took out a can of pepper spray as if it was insecticide, and as if these kids in front of him were insects of some sort. In fact, let me look at the article from the Washington Post. It looks as though he's spraying weeds in the garden or coating the oven with some kind of cleanser. It's not just a casual, dispassionate manner in which the University of California at Davis police officer pepper sprays a line of passive students sitting on the ground. It's the way that the can becomes merely a tool, an implement that diminishes the humanity of the students and widens a terrifying gulf between the police and the people whom they are entrusted to protect. The video, which shows the officer using the spray against Occupy protesters on Friday, went viral over the weekend. On Sunday, the university placed two police officers on administrative leave while a task force investigated. Administrative leave. This has been recorded on so many different videos, all different angles. This happened. This is not some kind of Photoshop conspiracy here. This happened. Administrative leave. That's where you pay somebody to do nothing. No, this guy should be in jail now. This guy should be facing all kinds of prosecution. And instead, he's protected. They won't even release his name. Well, you know what? We will release his name. His name is Lieutenant John Pike. And thanks to our friends at Anonymous, all of his information is out there. Dear Officer John Pike, we are Anonymous. Your information is now public domain. Expect our full wrath. Anonymous seeks to avenge all protesters. We are going to make you squeal like a pig. We have no problem targeting police and releasing their information, even if it puts them at risk, because we want them to experience just a taste of the brutality and misery they serve us on an everyday basis. Oh, yeah. Them's fighting words. But you know what? People can only be pushed so far. And then they start to fight back. There's a lot of admiration I have for passive resistance, civil disobedience, all that kind of thing. But there comes a point where people are brutalized to an extent where they start throwing rocks back. They start lighting those cop cars on fire. They start torching things. And if you want to see us pushed in that direction, these kinds of things are the way to go to get there. And then before you know it, you've got unrest like the rest of the world sees. You have it right here in our streets. But like I said, it's the police that lit the fuse. Continuing, though, with this story, the chancellor of the University of California at Davis said yesterday its police chief had been placed on administrative leave 3 days after two campus police officers sprayed seated protest. That's right, there were two of them. I don't know the other one's name. When we find out, we'll let you know. After two campus police officers sprayed seated protesters with pepper spray during a demonstration aligned with Occupy Wall Street, the university's chancellor, Linda P.B. Katehi, indicated that she was trying to calm the campus community and widespread outrage at the police tactics. Referring to the temporary removal of the police chief, Annette Spicuzza, Ms. Katehi said in a statement Monday, "It has become clear to me that this is a necessary step toward restoring trust on our campus." Well, yeah, you know what? It is. And I think it should go a lot further than that, because obviously, either you guys don't know what you're doing, or this is part of your policy. And it doesn't just stop at UC Davis. Let's look at all the schools. Let's look right here at Stony Brook. Is there pepper spray in the security office? Do they have some kind of directive to use that in certain situations? If a bunch of students sat down in front of the library or in front of the union building, would they actually do this? I think we need statements from people saying, no, we would not. We would never do that. These are our kids. We respect them. And that's the only way you're going to get them to respect you. The use of pepper spray came after students and other protesters set up tents on campus in a show of support for the Occupy movement and in solidarity with earlier protests at the University of California at Berkeley. The reactions to it, cries of police brutality and pledges to reconvene protesters on a larger scale, seem to mirror the reactions in New York, Seattle, and elsewhere when the police quelled recent protests with force. Seattle, that's another one. We don't have Kyle on the phone today, but if we did, we'd be talking about that old lady who was pepper sprayed. You seen that image? Yeah, she was a real threat, wasn't she? Back to California. 11 protesters were treated at the scene after being sprayed. Two of them were then sent to the hospital. 10 protesters were arrested on misdemeanor charges of unlawful assembly and failure to disperse and were later released. How many of the security officers were arrested and charged with failure to disperse and whatever else that they are guilty of? It's funny, and there is humor that we have to grasp at in stories like this. But I was following all kinds of Twitter accounts. You know, this is where Twitter comes in handy, actually, because it's a good way to get the word out to lots of people really, really quickly. And I was watching #OWS is what to follow if you want to see what's going on in the Zuccotti Park movement, and actually the whole Occupy Wall Street movement. But at one point when the police weren't letting anybody into the park, somebody tweeted that, the police are refusing to move out of Zuccotti Park. We're trying to figure out what their demands are. You know, echo of what everybody was saying about the Occupy Wall Street people. They've taken over the park. We don't know what their demands are. For quite a while, nobody knew just what it was exactly that the police expected people to do. Are we allowed in? Are we not allowed in? Should we be in the street? Should we go to another city? What? Tell us. Just tell us. And it really seemed like they didn't know half the time. After the episode, Ms. Spicuzza, hang on, which one is that again? Ms. Spicuzza is the police chief, yes. She told the Sacramento Bee that the students had surrounded the police, cutting the officers off from their support. That's a quote, cutting the officers off from their support. The videos, however, show no evidence of threats from the protesters. This from the New York Times, and this from looking at all the videos. So, yeah, you're lying. You're lying. You're just lying to cover up your officers, something we've seen done many times. But the difference now is that with all this people power and all this access to personal media, your lies can be exposed. Had there not been video, do you think they would have even admitted doing this in the first place? Of course not. You know, it all started with Rodney King, and boy, has it grown. When you catch the cops doing something bad, they try to make it illegal to film them now. That's the latest thing. You film a cop, well, that's a crime right there. It doesn't matter what the cop did. Filming them is a crime because they're superhuman and must not be captured. Their souls cannot be captured on film. Yeah. Good luck with that. Good luck with that versus outrage of the average person. The university said Sunday it had been flooded with comments, including some from alumni who pledged to stop donating. Bravo. In her statement on Sunday, Ms. Katahi, that's the university's chancellor, said, "I spoke with students this weekend, and I feel their outrage. I have also heard from an overwhelming number of students, faculty, staff, and alumni from around the country. I am deeply saddened that this happened on our campus. And as chancellor, I take full responsibility for the incident. However, I pledge to take the actions needed to ensure that this does not happen again." If you take full responsibility, then you're out of there too, because it's your fault. That's what full responsibility means. My bad. And when your bad results in a bunch of people being sent to the hospital, people that you're entrusted to take care of, when it involves you attacking them in an unprovoked manner, in a completely unnecessary manner, your ass is grass as far as I'm concerned. The president of the University of California system, it's going up a step here, Mark G. Udoff, did much the same on Sunday, saying in a statement that he was appalled by the images and that he would convene the system's 10 chancellors to discuss, quote, how to ensure proportional law enforcement response to nonviolent protest. The time has come to take strong action to recommit to the ideal of peaceful protest, he said. That at least sounds like, wow, we know how screwed up things are and we've got to do something now. That's the kind of reaction that we do need to hear. Of course, I'm not sure he should resign, too. Maybe he should. But at least he's saying the right things. In the capital of Sacramento, protesters marched to a home owned by Governor Jerry Brown. Not his home, a home owned by Jerry Brown. Amazing. They marched there on Saturday to denounce what they called violence perpetrated by the police. Elsewhere on Saturday, 13 members of an Occupy group in Washington were arrested after occupying an abandoned school building, according to local reports. Again, you know, abandoned buildings. This is just a personal thing with me. I don't understand if it's abandoned, what difference does it make if people are in it? It's abandoned. You know, nobody is in there. Yeah, there are all kinds of safety concerns, I suppose, but the abandoned building is there regardless. It doesn't seem quite logical that you move in, beat the crap out of people to keep them safe. Doesn't seem logical. On Sunday, the police in Oakland, California, where tear gas was fired at protesters last month, and that's where that Iraq War veteran was critically wounded by the police, shooting at him point blank with something that we still don't know what exactly it was. They evicted protesters at an encampment that had been set up a day earlier in a vacant lot. At least that time, the protesters were given time to move their tents. But saying public safety remained her first priority, Mayor Jean Kwan said in a statement, "We will not tolerate lodging on public property, whether in parks or open space. It is illegal." Well, you know, it is. It is illegal. But it is also a vacant lot. Vacant meaning nothing is there. And if all of a sudden you bring free speech there and have all kinds of lively discourse back and forth, I say that's an improvement on a vacant lot. Why is that a bad thing? And yeah, sure, it's illegal. You can point to that. You could say it's illegal for people to lodge on public property. What about all the homeless people? Yeah, all those people sleeping on subway grates and in corners and ATM vestibules. I guess that's illegal too. But we sort of close our eyes to that. We kind of walk past and pretend that's not there. Because, well, what's the solution? Can't really spray them with pepper spray, can we? Well, maybe we can. But when it's really in your face, you know, when there's a bunch of people and they're shouting mad, and you can see them and you can hear them, that's when you got to move in. That's when all of a sudden public safety becomes an issue. Yeah, you know, somebody lying on a sidewalk, freezing to death, picking up all kinds of diseases, starving. That's not a public safety. That's not a health issue. We can walk past that. But when it's a bunch of people together and they start to feel power and they start to mobilize, then you got to say, yeah, who's flushing the toilets? Who's making sure that they get 3 balanced meals a day? Who's taking care of criminal issues? All of a sudden, the concern arises. Yeah. I don't buy it. Sorry, I don't buy it. All right. Remember, John Pike, that's the guy's name. The guy who did the pepper spraying. Officer John Pike. We'll find out the other guy's name. And you know, John Pike, if you're out there listening, what you need to do is you need to get to a microphone, you need to get to a camera, you need to talk to people and tell them why you did what you did and whether you really feel that was the right thing to do. That's the only way out of this. People do listen to people. They don't listen to press releases. And this is just great. This is classic. What do you think Fox News went and did? They described pepper spray as a food product. Yeah, I got this from Russia Today. Russia Today, they're having a blast with this. Russia Today loves it when there's civil unrest in the United States. They really do. And you know, every time I direct people to Russia Today post, the reaction, I always get this reaction from somebody saying, well, you know, do they cover their own protests in the same way? Of course not. They don't. They cover things up. Yes, we know this. It doesn't mean when they report on something that's actually happening in our streets that we're covering up doesn't make it any less valid. So, yeah, I read Russia Today. to find out the things that my own media is not telling us. One thing in particular, get this. The local Fox station here in New York City, the main anchor for that particular station is the son of the police commissioner. Now, if that was the case in Libya or Iran or something like that, we'd say, yeah, of course, that's how things are done in third world dictatorships. The son of the police commissioner gets the prime job of informing the people what's going on. And of course, he is one of the people mocking the Occupy Wall Street protesters day after day on the morning program. Son of the police commissioner. Yeah, it happens right here in this country. It happens in a different way. We use a capitalist-based system to get there. And it's not imposed by the government, supposedly. But it still is an interesting way to realize how we get our news. But anyway, yeah, Fox News. this is what aired on Bill O'Reilly's show. This was yesterday, on Monday. Megyn Kelly. She said, it's like a derivative of actual pepper. It's a food product, essentially. Yeah. They couldn't figure out why people are getting so upset at being pepper sprayed. Yeah. Now let's be honest here. Yeah, it is a food product. You want to call it that, but it's 20 times stronger than the hottest habanero pepper. It's been linked to deaths. It can cause cell and eyeball damage. It's issued to the U.S. military, as Russia Today says, sounds scrumptious. And she went on to say, I don't know if from a legal standpoint the cops did anything wrong. Yeah. Meanwhile, in Time magazine, we have this a bit more educated coverage here. A video footage of police using pepper spray on police protesting students at the University of California in Davis on the 18th has been a source of national outrage since. The use of such brutal force against passive protesters isn't as uncommon as you'd think. Pepper spray and other severe tactics have recently been used with disturbing frequency by police against Occupy protesters, young, old, pregnant, you name it. The agent misuse, agent being the pepper spray agent, goes back much further. In the mid-1990s, the U.S. Department of Justice cited nearly 70 fatalities linked to pepper spray use. And basically, how painful is it to get pepper spray, in case you're curious, in case you want to go out and give it a try, you know, this Thanksgiving or something, you know, have some of this food product. Well, police-grade pepper spray gets 5,300,000 Scoville heat units on the Scoville scale of pepper hotness. Yeah, I bet you didn't know that existed. The Scoville scale of pepper hotness. Now, okay, the habanero pepper gets 350,000 Scoville units, as opposed to 5,300,000 for pepper spray. So, yeah, it's pretty hot. It is. Now, in most cases of pepper spray use, the agent is non-lethal, but as noted, it can cause irreparable harm or death. According to a 2004 paper by researchers at the University of North Carolina School of Public Health and Duke University Medical Center, high-dose exposure to the spray can produce adverse cardiac, respiratory, neurological effects, including arrhythmias and sudden death. Getting pepper sprayed is worse than getting maced. Mace causes burning but no respiratory effects. Pepper spray can fell even people with a high tolerance for pain because it restricts the airway and leaves you gasping for breath. Even when pepper spray isn't inhaled, its effect on the skin and eyes can require hospital attention, causing intense burning pain, swelling, inflammation, and redness. Classified as a riot control agent banned for use in war by Article 1.5 of the Chemical Weapons Convention, pepper spray is meant to be used against violent attackers who are resisting arrest and threatening physical harm to others. That doesn't apply to what we've seen, obviously. If you do find yourself being sprayed, try not to breathe in. Don't rub your face. Be careful of cold temperatures. Use the right soap. Make your health problems public. And don't resist arrest. It tends to make things even worse. And before we leave, and we do have to go, unfortunately, we have that basketball game coming up in just a few minutes. This just happened. Students angry over a tuition hike tried to crash a City University of New York Board of Trustees meeting yesterday, and they were met with baton-wielding campus cops at Baruch College. Yeah, they battered protesters, forced them out of the lobby at the of the Flatiron District School, and then they arrested 15 demonstrators. So, you know, it's a sickness. in the whole country of violent reactions to nonviolent protesters. It's really sad. Hey, write to us, otw@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you with any kind of feedback, information. Again, we'll be on recording for the next few weeks. Back again, hopefully as soon as we can. And we'll have a special guest tomorrow on Off the Hook. We'll have one of the guys who is running the live stream of video of what was going on in New York City last Thursday, last Tuesday. It'll be really interesting. That's tomorrow night at 7. So we'll see you again. Stay tuned for Columbia versus Stony Brook coming up in just a few minutes. Emmanuel Furr, Off the Wall. Good night.
The old man turned off the radio, said, "Where did all of the old songs go? Kids sure play funny music these days. They play it in the strangest way. Said, it looks to me like they've all gone wild. It was peaceful back when I was a child. Well, man, could it be the girls and boys are trying to be heard above your noise? And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?" A little boy of 3 sitting on the floor looks up and says, "Daddy, what is war?" "Son, that's when people fight and die." A little boy of 3 says, "Daddy, why?" Young man of 17 in Sunday school being taught the golden rule. And by the time another year's gone around, it may be his turn to lay his life down. Can you blame the voice of youth for asking what is truth? Young man sitting on the witness stand, the man with the book says, "Raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear." The man looked down at his long hair, and although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, "What is truth?" Young girl dancing to the latest beat has found new ways to move her feet. A young man speaking in the city square is trying to tell somebody that he cares. Yeah, the ones that you're calling wild are gonna be the leaders in a little while. This old world's waking to a newborn day, and I solemnly swear that it'll be their way. You better help that voice of you find what is true. And the lonely voice of youth cries, "What is truth?"
This is Derek Jeter of the New York Yankees. You're listening to the place where unique sounds begin, 90.1 FM, WUSB, Stony Brook.
Good evening, everyone. It's 6:45 p.m. That means it is time for Stony Brook Seawolves basketball. Today, the men take on the Lions of Columbia from Pritchard Gym. And here are Mike Solano, Kurt Hilton, and Jeff Bernstein.
And thanks very much, Matt Mankiewicz. And good evening once again, ladies and gentlemen, to Stony Brook University Athletics right here on WUSB 90.1 FM, along with Jeff Bernstein. I'm Mike Solano. Kurt Hilton joining us in just a few minutes. And following an historic weekend for Stony Brook football, it's a little Thanksgiving appetizer on the basketball court this evening as the Seawolves renew their decade-long rivalry against the Ivy League Lions of Columbia. This has been a terrific rivalry over the past 10 years. The last 8 of these matchups decided by 5 points or less. The last 3 games between these two teams have been decided by 3 points or less. So always a hotly contested down-the-wire battle, whether it's Stony Brook or Columbia on the winning side at the end of the ball game, Jeff. So we expect a good one here tonight for Stony Brook, a chance to rebound from a little bit of a lackluster performance last time out up at Sacred Heart.
So what you're saying is we can just fast forward to 8:55 tonight, and it'll pretty much be a Nick and Tuck game.
There'll be something exciting going on.
Yeah. It's a great rivalry between the New York City-based Columbia Lions and the Stony Brook Seawolves. It's been a great rivalry, as you mentioned, year after year. Comes down to the last possession. As a coach, you don't want that. You want to pretty much have a comfortable lead. But for some reason, both teams always match up well against each other. This Columbia team is a little bit different, where it's got more size than usual with guard play. I mean, they have a really good guard, but their strength really is pretty much their strength. The big men, pretty much a strength. Why they hung into the game against Connecticut that they played on November 11th. They only lost 70-57. It was an 8-point game, obviously, in that game. But Stony Brook, I think, is more worried about Stony Brook, Mike. They played a halfway decent game against Sacred Heart defensively. Steve Peichel didn't like it, gave up too many points. And if Stony Brook's going to win this game tonight, they're going to do it defensively. Not really worried about the offense. They're going to do it defensively. The defense is going to create the offense.
Yeah, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago when the team was playing Mount Ida, that they had the Indiana game to start things off. Hard to judge there when you're going against a Big Ten team. And then Mount Ida at the D2 level, hard to judge exactly what you have. We looked at Sacred Heart as the first test for the Stony Brook team, the first chance to really assess what they were coming in with. And we saw some holes. We saw some needs for improvement, especially on the glass. Stony Brook was out-rebounded by Sacred Heart, 39-28. They also allowed the Pioneers to shoot 49% from the field. Really, one of the glaring statistics that jumps out, 13 offensive rebounds for Sacred Heart, 14 second-chance points off of that. So as you said, the defense needs to step it up for Stony Brook, especially on the glass. Guys like Dallas Joyner and Tommy Britton will have to pick up their games against this Columbia team, which has some big bodies.
You know, well, you know, sometimes we say that the Seawolves only have Ron Bracey as the newcomer right now. I think technically we're wrong. I think they have two newcomers, Ron Bracey and Tommy Britton, because Tommy wasn't here last year and, you know, wasn't any part of the team. He also has to go through an adjustment period, in my opinion, because at the Sacred Heart game, Mike, it just seems that where he was and where the team was wasn't really on the same page. And Ron also himself, he's not on the same page, I think, defensively right now that head coach Steve Peichel wants him to be. So I think that this team really needs to just to be cohesive as a unit.
And nobody knows what this team needs more than its head coach, Steve Peichel. Earlier this afternoon, Jeff caught up with the head man for the Seawolves, and here are his thoughts heading into tonight's matchup.
Columbia, we're talking to the head men's basketball coach, Steve Peichel. And, Coach, some initial thoughts about tonight's game.
Well, I mean, this has been an unbelievable series through the year since I've been here. Every game's been decided by a possession or so. You know, and coming back off of a tough loss to Sacred Heart in a game that I didn't like the way we played at all. It's a real important game for us. And I know we're well prepared for it. And I want to get back to playing Stony Brook University defense, which we've kind of built this program around, which hasn't been, you know, to my liking the last few games. They have a very, very good point guard. They have a big guy inside who's going to cause us major problems because of his size. And they're a very good, well-coached, disciplined basketball team. So a real tough challenge for us. I'm glad we're at home. Want to try to keep our streak at home alive. We're 1-0, and we're trying to be 2-0. Make this a real tough place to play before we have to go on the road to which will probably be the toughest game of the season at Northwestern out in Chicago, a team that just beat Tulsa, and we'll be ranked soon too. So a real difficult game coming up. So this tonight, very, very important for us.
Now, on paper, Columbia has a deceiving record of 0-3, but as you know, they played a UConn team pretty tough, and UConn is one of the teams that could win the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, they out-rebounded UConn. It was an 8-point game with a few minutes, you know, left. So, you know, a couple possession game against the national championship team on their court with their referees. So this team's very good. They've been up in all the games they played in. They played a very good American team and firm team. They had leads in both games. You know, it's going to be a real difficult war for us, and it always has been. In this rivalry, and it's really been a game just that comes down to one or two possessions. So they've out-rebounded their opponents in all those games, and they've really done a great job of defending. Those are two things that we pride ourselves in that we haven't brought to the table this year. So it's going to be a war tonight. It's a very important game for both teams, and You know, hopefully we'll play well and come out on the right side of this thing.
I know primarily you're concerned about how Stony Brook comes out to play tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I want us to play defense, Jeff, for, you know, quite honestly. I mean, we're giving up 85 points in our two Division I games, and, you know, that's not what we do. That's not who we are. It's a veteran team. They know that. It's just a matter of getting them to do it now. And, you know, we're going to play a lot of guys again tonight. We're going to try to play our tails off for as many minutes as they can go, and then hopefully you'll see a lot of guys raising their hands that they're exhausted and that they need a blow, and we'll come in with another wave of guys. And, you know, we got to get back to what made us good in a good program, and that's defense and rebound, and we haven't done that. And, therefore, you know, we haven't had the kind of start that we would like.
Coach, best of luck tonight.
Thank you.
And that's Steve Pikul, the Seawolves head coach, as they get set for the Columbia Lions. And just to reiterate what Coach Pikul was saying, it's been a hard early beginning to this season for Columbia, an 0-3 team, but a very deceptive record. They have been all of their games, as Coach Pikul mentioned, hung right in there till the end with Connecticut. And in their two other matchups against Furman and American, Jeff, losing those tight games, had leads in those ball games. So this is a Columbia team coming in here hungry for its first win of the year.
Absolutely. They need a win. They're reeling as well, and they're going to face a tough Manhattan team. We saw that Manhattan team last year, one of the top teams in the metro area. And so Columbia trying to get off the schneid, Stony Brook trying to get off the schneid, and I think it's a battle of two teams that are trying to pretty much show what they're about in the metropolitan area. But I think more, you know, to a degree, say Stony Brook beats Sacred Heart, you know, and a little bit of a fat cat, you know, they would have came into this Columbia maybe overlooking them. So in essence, maybe the Sacred Heart loss comes early. You know, Stony Brook may have gotten on a run and then had a fat cat and said, oh, we took a tough loss. They took the tough loss early. So maybe they can try to fix this early and then maybe hopefully go on a run from here.
And as Columbia comes into this game without one of its key players, Narua Ago, who was injured 8 days ago in the matchup against Furman, the senior guard will miss this game. He's out indefinitely with an injury. But for Steve Pikul, Jeff, it's another opportunity, as he talked about, to assess this year's team, a very deep Stony Brook team. So looking to get the right personnel out there at the right time, little tweaks to the starting lineup again this evening. So there's still a lot of talent to go around and a lot of minutes to go around on this Stony Brook team. This time of the year, it's a matter of just finding out who fits into what minutes at what point.
To me, Mike, when you have a lot of guys, a lot of talented guys, and you can use pretty much the sort of the hockey analogy too, it's very tough, I think, early to find a set lineup until it's going to take a while. You know, because you have a lot of guys, a lot of talent. I mean, you like to have the depth, but in terms of the substitution rotation, I think it's tough in the beginning to find that set 7, 8, 9 guys. I mean, if Steve Pikul can go through the whole season and play 10, you know, they're going to win, and they're going to go to the whole league of the NCAA tournament. If they have to go down to 7 and 8, you know, then it's going to be a little tougher. But if they can go solid 10 guys throughout the entire season, they're going to have a great year.
And so far having a decent year, Dallas Joyner in his senior season coming in, averaging just less than 10 points a game, a little less than 6 rebounds a game as well, Jeff, as we saw him last year as a guy who really stepped up in the midway point of the season, became a force on the glass. He's having a good start to the season. And Tommy Brenton, we mentioned him, still trying to get the game legs back, still trying to find that court awareness that we know he has, all those intangible qualities. Nonetheless, he's still leading this team by a wide margin with 8.3 rebounds a contest. Ryan Dewar is a guy I'd like to see start getting going in the shooting category. He's averaging 9.3 points a game, which is second on the team, but not quite up to his usual production. 6 of 17 thus far, 35% from three-point range, but just 9 of 25 from inside the arc.
Well, spoke to Tommy the other day, and Tommy came to the Iona women's game and to support the women. And I said, Tommy, you look a little different. You shaved your beard. You know, he took the whole thing off. Looks like he's 17 years old again. And Tommy said, well, I had a discussion with my mom, and my mom said, wow, you're letting your beard grow out. Didn't say, I don't like it. She said, oh, you're letting it grow out. So Tommy got the word in it from his mom, and that way, in essence, to say it's coming off. So maybe Tommy is, you know, by taking the beard off, saying, okay, you know, the beard was a nice little mirage, and now it's going to be all about business.
I think maybe a more accurate inflection would have been, oh, you're letting your beard grow out?
Right, right, exactly.
That was the hint that Tommy needed. So it's a cleanly shaven Tommy Benn here as the teams are out on the court getting ready for their the opening tip here, going through their final warm-up drills. And as we said, this has been a terrific series between these teams that began in the 2002-2003 season. Six of the previous eight matchups have been decided by five or less. The last three games have been near instant classics, going down to the wire in all three cases with the 3-point or less differentials. The last matchup last year at Columbia was won by the Lions 73-72, a game where the Seawolves jumped out to a big lead, and that was an early storyline, Jeff, for the Seawolves last year, was getting out to those big leads, not being able to hang on down the stretch. They were able to right the ship once they got into conference play, but last year were victimized by 11 three-pointers from Columbia, including seven by Steve Frankowski, and lost that game at the wire 73-72. So the perimeter shooting also for the Seawolves, because Sacred Heart did a nice job from deep as well.
That was the bugaboo, if you remember, last year. Stony Brook couldn't defend the three-point shot. You know, got burned on a lot of threes. You saw that against Manhattan last year in the Blocker Buster game. And it happened many times where defending the three-point shot was the key. That'll be a situation today that should be a very interesting one. Have a lot of big low-post players, so that means you really have to play them. So what Columbia will probably do is go down first and then use the guards for some open threes, and that should be a good situation there. But I think this is you could admit, Mike, that this is a much better defensive team than last year's team. So hopefully the Seawolves won't get burned on the big shot.
Well, we'll see if the Seawolves can up that perimeter defense, and that defense in general for Coach Peichel's team. As we mentioned, the Seawolves giving up too many points in the early goings of their previous Division I games. One of the key statistics for Steve Peichel, you know, he loves to keep the opponents under 60 points. Columbia's a team that has come close but has not yet scored 60 points or more on the year, so that is a key number that factors into this game as well. Just a minute or so away from the opening tip-off as we welcome Kurt Hilton into the broadcast position. We'll get his thoughts on this game in just a moment, but quickly we run down the starting lineups here for the Seawolves and Columbia. As mentioned, Columbia without one of its senior guards, Narua Ago. They'll be starting Brian Barber, their leading scorer at nearly 15 points a game, at guard, junior from Alamo, California. He's in the backcourt along with Miko Lyles, a sophomore from Nashville, Tennessee. Up front, it's John Daniels, a 6'7 junior from Sioux City, Iowa, along with the senior Matt Johnson at 6'7, another California native. Mark Sitko is the man in the middle at 6'9. He's a New Jersey native in his junior season. And meanwhile, over on the other side for the Seawolves, we mentioned some changes to the lineup. Dave Coley along with Brian Dewar and Lenny Hayes, the three guards in the backcourt, and up front, the combination of Joyner and Brenton, which will go up against Mark Sitko and some of these tall bodies that Columbia has on its staff.
Kurt loves these games. You know why? Against Stony Brook Columbia, because you don't have to look at the roster. You know, Columbia is almost like a pseudo member of the America East. You play them every year. You know these guys from Columbia just like Stony Brook.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just one of those familiar opponents where every year you dial it up, and like you guys have said, every year it comes down to the wire.
See how it goes today as we send it courtside for the national anthem. Thank you. Star-Spangled Banner here at Pritchard Gymnasium being performed by Anna Lubitz, who also did those chores on Saturday at the Stony Brook Liberty football game. So maybe Anna, in addition to her voices, bringing a little of that championship rope here to Pritchard Gymnasium tonight to try and get the Seawolves over the hump against Columbia.
And speaking of Pritchard, you got to really give the students a little bit of credit tonight. Tonight is one of those getaway nights for Thanksgiving weekend, and they still have that whole student section pretty much filled.
Absolutely. They did their roll call, led by the band before the game, and a lot of fans on hand here tonight. Looked a little sparse about 20 minutes ago, but the fans have shown up for this one as we get set for the tip-off between Columbia and Stony Brook. And Kirk, had a brief chance to get your thoughts there right at the beginning in this tight contest. But as you look at these two rosters and the matchups that these two teams have had over the years, for Seawolves, we called last week against Sacred Heart the first real litmus test for this team. It was not a good one, at least in the minds of the coaching staff. Team was out-rebounded, outplayed at the end of the game by Sacred Heart. What recovery does the team make here tonight against a team that has given them fits in the past?
Well, I think, look, I was reading on a couple of places today, like, fans get a little crazy. I saw one where, hey, if the Seawolves lose this game tonight, the season's over. Forget it. That's crazy. You know, that's crazy.
They said that against after Manhattan last year.
Absolutely. You know, a basketball team typically takes longer to evolve. And I think a lot of it has to do with some of the system. And Steve Peichel's a guy who, he uses early season experimentation and shuffles his lineup a lot. We're seeing that tonight here. And he experiments and he tries to find a core group that he'll go with for the remainder of that year. And he does it every year. A lot of coaches kind of just plug guys back in based on where they were the year before. That's not his methodology. Does it hurt them early in the season sometimes? Possibly. But I think tonight, the thing that he didn't like against Sacred Heart, and Jeff, you were there, was the effort on the rebounding and the effort on defense. He's the kind of guy, hey, I don't care if you miss a shot, if it's a good shot, but you've got to be tough, you got to rebound, and you got to play defense, and you got to bring it every possession. And he didn't think they did that against Sacred Heart. I think they'll do that tonight. This is a very big, physical Columbia team, but they don't have a lot of pure scores, but they're going to be tough and get in your stuff on defense and on the glass. The Seawolves have to reciprocate.
Kurt may be frustrated tonight. One of the officials here tonight, John Hughes, was the official at Indiana, hey, who got to the video about nine times last. So Kurt may be shaking his head tonight.
I looked at the roster and I saw that and I was like, we could be in for a long one.
Hey, the best Thanksgiving movie of all time is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, so it's only fitting that John Hughes is the referee here this evening, along with Jim Lachansky and Doug Grant rounding out the officiating crew. Seawolves wearing the home whites, red numbers trimmed in silver. The red, white-silver pattern down the shorts, red numbers and letters across the front. The letters reading out Stony Brook and Fort Columbia. The road sky blues, white stripe down the jerseys and the shorts. White numbers trimmed in a darker shade of blue. Joyner set to tip things off against Cisco as John Hughes gets set to put the ball in the air. He does. Two tips and Joyner wins it back to Lenny Hayes and we're underway. Ryan Dewar takes it across the timeline and signals the play and dribbles to the right side. Passes to Dave Coley, top of the arc. He'll come around to the left of the circle. Up top once again to Brenton. He wants to drive in left side. Shovel pass back to Coley. Pulls up free throw line. Jumper short. Rebound up for grabs. Cisco hauls it in for Columbia. Ahead for John Daniels. We'll get it to Brian Barber, team's leading scorer. 14.7 points a game. Does most of his damage inside, though. Just 4 of 16 from three-point range early on. A great free-throw shooter as well. Over in the near corner, it's Matt Johnson. Johnson goes baseline against Hayes, gets stood up by Joyner, kicks it outside to Miko Lyles. Lyles against Dewar. Over to Barber for three. Rims around, no good, and Hayes there for the rebound. Ahead for Dewar along the near sideline. Dewar back to Hayes. Has an open lane along the right, angles into the paint. Gets it over to Joyner on the baseline, 10 feet from the basket. Outlet pass up top for Coley and around to Brenton and Hayes once again. In the corner, Dewar. Inside, low post, left side for Joyner. Seawolves going left to right in this opening half as Joyner goes to the sky hook and puts it in for the first points of the game.
Hey, how big is this Columbia team? Lenny Hayes is guarding Matt Johnson, who's really listed as a guard, but he's 6'7", 210, and has a game more like a four-man.
Johnson with the ball right there, gets it inside to Cisco, gets his own miss on the layup, hands it off to Daniels, and an offensive foul called against Columbia, negating what would have been a basket.
This is a type of game that Stony Brook, when they play Maine, play against the trees, try to keep them out of the paint, and you know, limit the low post plays.
Beg pardon there, traveling violation against Columbia. Give the ball to the Seawolves. Minute 40 gone by as Hayes pulls up on the arc. Throws it over to Coley on the left side and up top once again for Joyner. Joyner to Dewar, sets a screen. Dewar dribbles into the paint, kicks it out and around. It comes up top to Brent, who fakes the three, tries to go around Daniels and draws the contact. So John Daniels, guilty party on the first foul of the night.
And there's the savvy of a Tommy Brenton. He not only makes the head fake and then puts the ball on the deck, but as the defender gets up in the air, he raises his right arm and draws the contact and gets the foul.
Brenton trying to hand it off to Coley. A little miscommunication on the exchange, but the Seawolves recover. And now it's Dewar up top. Fresh shot clock. 2 minutes gone by. 25 seconds remaining on that clock. Here's Brenton with a bounce pass into Joyner. He feeds it across the paint to a cutting Coley, who lays it in with the right hand.
When you've got a guard who's as active as Coley is, and Jeff made mention of this the last couple of broadcasts, how Coley has been attacking the offensive glass. It sets up your postman very nicely. Joyner double team, finds a cutter.
Barber dribbles near sideline, gets it out to Cisco's off the free throw line of the near side of the floor. As Columbia goes left to right, Barber directs traffic from the top right corner. So Johnson and back to Barber, and around it comes to Daniels. Daniels around the arc it goes. Now back to the top for Lyles. Tries to go right side against Dewar. Pulls up just off the free throw line. Feeds Daniels. Tries to go along the paint. The baseline, rather. And turned around for a hook shot as shot clock wound down. Stony Brook takes over the basketball.
Coach Pica likes to play with the minds of the Seawolves players. All week of practice, the scoreboard said 74-63. That was the score of the Sacred Heart game. To get into these guys' minds, they didn't like the 74 points put up by the Sacred Heart Pioneers.
Hayes left wing, drives in against Johnson. Kick out to Dewar. Back outside corner for Hayes for three over everything. With Coley there for the rebound and the putback in one fluid motion. 6-0 Seawolves, 16-48 and counting to go in the opening half. Danny Carter getting set to check in at the scorer's table. Here comes Al Rapier as well. Meanwhile, Columbia, nice little give and go to Barber. Kicks back out to Daniels and around to Johnson up top. Johnson has Hayes out on him. 18 on the shot clock. Ball poked away by Brenton toward midcourt. Picked up in backcourt by Daniels, and Brenton right there to cover him. Barber came over to help. He takes the ball across midcourt with 8 seconds left to shoot. Picks up his dribble short of the three-point line. Over to Lyles for three. No good from the right side. Brenton will let the rebound go out over the far sideline. And the Seawolves get it back once again. Still shutting out Columbia through 3 minutes and 45 seconds as Rapier and Carter check in.
You know, Columbia, as Kurt mentioned, very, very big. Has a good guard, but I'm not sure if they're skilled as much as when Joe Jones had very good guards when he was there. You know, Jones now over at Boston U.
Yeah, taking on a different look, more size, certainly successful last year at 16 and 12.
Carter puts up a shot, 18 feet out on the far baseline. That's way short. Never got to the rim and taken away by Columbia. Joyner, Brenton out for the Seawolves on the substitutions. Now here comes Anthony Jackson to the scorer's table along with Ron Bracey. Get a whistle down low over in the far corner. Foul going against Raper and the Seawolves, and that brings us to our first official timeout of the night. Good start for the Seawolves. 15:45 remaining in the first half with the score Seawolves 6, Columbia nothing. You're listening to the longtime home of Seawolves Sports, WUSB.
And back in the studios of WUSB, Matt Mankiewicz here. There are some other American